Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, where audio and video links to past programs are available. I'm Jeffrey Brand, professor and chairman of the Center for Law and Global Justice at the University of San Francisco School of Law, and your moderator for today's program. And I'm so pleased now to introduce our distinguished guests, Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld, authors, law professors, and I think it fair to say insightful social critics, or perhaps agent provocateurs, or both, depending on your perspective. And if you have a television or radio or you've been on the internet, you no doubt know of our two distinguished guests. Amy Chua is the John M. Duff Professor of Law at the Yale Law School, where she has taught contracts and international business transactions. She's been there since 2001, and before that was a professor at Duke. Amy received her bachelor's and her law degree from Harvard and has practiced at the law firm of Cleary Gottlieb. And her husband, Jed Rubenfeld, also teaches at the Yale Law School, where he is the Robert R. Slaughter Professor of Law and taught constitutional and criminal law, privacy, and the First Amendment. Professor Rubenfeld also graduated from Harvard Law School, where he met his wife, Amy, who, as I understand it, was 1 year behind. Amy Chua is the daughter of well-educated Chinese parents who grew up in a household, if I have my quotes right, where receiving an A- was unthinkable. Jed Rubenfeld is the son of self-described liberal, permissive Jewish parents, a remark I resemble, his father a psychotherapist, and his mother an art critic. Both are distinguished authors, Professor Rubenfeld having recently written Freedom, Time, and Revolution by Judiciary, and Professor Chua having written on global economics, including the acclaimed World on Fire, How Exporting Free Market Democracy Breeds Ethnic Hatred and Global Instability. But of course, it's not those works that we're here to talk about today. Rather, we gather to discuss a controversial new book by this married Yale law professor couple who come, I think fair to say, from very different backgrounds. The book, The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. This book, of course, follows Professor Chua's equally controversial book, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, that was published in 2011 and landed on the bestseller list and also created itself somewhat of a firestorm. The critical reaction to the book has already lit up the internet. It's been described as a great book as recently as 72 hours ago. It's been described in The Atlantic as providing insight into other cultures and a good guide for striving parents. On the other hand, it's been described as pop psychology and ersatz self-help manual. And what I'm thrilled about today is that we have the opportunity to draw our own conclusions, and we thank Professors Chua and Rubenfeld for joining us to describe in their own words and to answer questions that I and that you have. So let's get to it. Please welcome Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld to the Commonwealth Club. And I think the way we'll do this is Professor Rubenfeld, Jed is going to start, and then Amy will have a few comments, and then Jed a couple of follow-up comments, and then we'll engage in a conversation. Jed.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for that introduction. What an honor it is for us to be at the Commonwealth Club. I want to thank all of you for coming out on this Valentine's Day at noon. I really appreciate that. 4 weeks ago, Amy and I, we're teachers at Yale. We were in a coffee shop in New Haven, and we happened to overhear a couple having conversation. The woman says, "Did you hear about the two professors who are arguing that some races are superior to others?" Well, Amy and I were aghast, and we interrupted, and we demanded to know who the despicable professors were. And the woman said, "Oh, it's the Tiger Mom." And we were speechless, which she evidently initially mistook for our not knowing who the Tiger Mom was, because what she said was, "Oh, you know, that crazy Chinese woman and her white..." So that was basically how the odyssey of the last 3 or 4 weeks started for us, in which we repeatedly heard a book described in the media and online, which we literally could not recognize as the book we had written. So it's really a great pleasure for us to be able to come out and try to say to you what we think our book is really about, which is The Rise and Fall of Groups. It's a book about three qualities that propel individuals and groups to success. But not only about that, it's also about the very predictable way that those traits get eroded over time, in part by success and in part by a process of creative destruction that occurs when these traits interact with American culture. Now, the starting point for our book is a seemingly un-American fact about America today, which is this striking phenomenon that for some groups, much more than the rest of the country, people are experiencing exceptional rates of upward mobility. I mean, we hear a lot about the death of upward mobility, tough economy, shrinking opportunity, and yet, for some groups, much more than the rest of the country, rates of success and upward mobility are really quite astonishing. And let me just give you a few of the facts that are out there so you know what we're talking about. So Indian Americans, their household income is about $90,000. That's about twice the national household income, which is about $50,000. Lebanese Americans and Iranian Americans, their income's not far behind that. Asian American kids score 140 points higher on average on their SATs than the rest of the country. Asian Americans who make up about 5% of the population are now about 20% of the Ivy League student body, and a lot of people think that number is artificially depressed by a bias against Asian Americans in the Ivy League. Now, how about this? What do the current or recent CEOs or CFOs of the following corporations have in common? American Express, Black & Decker, Citigroup, Dell, Fisher-Price, Sears Roebuck, Skull Candy, Sam's Club, Huntsman. This list goes on. Dell, there are a whole number of corporations I could continue listing. JetBlue. What they all have in common is they're all Mormon. And this is, you know, very interesting because 30 years ago it was difficult to find a Mormon on Wall Street. I know, I worked on Wall Street. It was difficult to find a Mormon in corporate boardrooms, and yet now, just 30 years later, they are really hitting it out of the park in terms of corporate success. Nigerian Americans. Fascinating case. Nigerian Americans make up less than 1% of the U.S. black population, but their representation in selective elite schools is 10 times higher than that. In fact, at Harvard Business School, they make up about a quarter of the black student body at Harvard Business School. It's really extraordinary. Cuban Americans are another disproportionately successful group. Again, a very small percentage of the nation's Hispanic population. They're wildly overrepresented on lists of wealthy Hispanics. All three of our U.S. senators that are Hispanic are Cuban Americans. Now, this list of these groups, there are literally dozens of groups that are outperforming the national average. We focus on the eight groups that I just mentioned. I left one out, Jewish Americans. In a way, their success is the best documented of all. It's also the most fraught and broad-based. Jewish Americans, they're less than 2% of the population, but they, just for example, They've won over a third of America's Nobel Prizes, and a third of the current Supreme Court justices are Jewish, too. But there are literally dozens of these groups. We focus on these groups in our book. We wish we could have written a longer book and talked about more groups. We focus on these groups because, in a way, their success is the most easily measurable and the most striking. Now, the real question is, what explains this striking, disproportionate success? And what I want to tell you, and I can't emphasize this enough, just to say that some groups are doing better in these conventional ways, educationally and income, obviously that's not the same as saying they are better or that they are culturally or innately superior. On the contrary, we prove in our book that that's just not so. So when researchers dug in to the data about Asian American academic performance, you know what they found? Third generation Asian Americans, their academic performance is no different from the rest of the country. Now think about that. That proves that it's not innate. That proves it's not racial. That proves it's not biological. That explodes the whole model minority myth, and it's an example of how these successful traits change over time and how the groups that are successful today are not the same as they would have 20 years ago. The groups would have been different. 20 years from now, the groups would be different. Now, I know what a lot of you are probably thinking. You know what the explanation is? It's probably class and immigrant selectivity. It's probably a phenomenon of wealthy parents passing on advantage to their kids, or of immigrants coming over with high levels of education or high skills. That would be the most comforting explanation. And those are important factors. But they're just not as important as people think they are. They don't nearly explain the whole story. So Mormon Americans who are doing so well in the business world today, most of them, Mitt Romney notwithstanding, we all have that example in our minds, Mitt Romney notwithstanding, they came from humble working class origins. One study showed about 9 out of 10 came from humble working class origins. The Jewish Americans who came over 100 years ago, millions of them from Eastern Europe and Russia. My grandfather was one of them. Butchers, tailors, and despite what you may have heard, not well educated. And they rose, their kids rose. But the best studied community of all may be Asian Americans, particularly Chinese, Korean, and Vietnamese Americans. Now, this data is available. People have studied this. And what it shows is the following, that their kids are succeeding and achieving the highest grades and scores regardless of their parents' socioeconomic status and educational background. That is to say that the kids of restaurant workers and dry cleaners, poorly educated, are doing just as well as the kids of the Asian Americans who are better educated, and all of them are doing better than their white, more privileged, better educated peers. That's the phenomenon that needs to be explained. It's not class. It's not immigrant selectivity in this group. You know, a lot of people have mistaken our claim, like, oh, we're comparing one immigrant group to another immigrant group, and we're saying one's better than the other. That's not what we're saying at all. Or we're comparing one immigrant group to other poor groups. That's not what we're saying at all. The phenomenon that needs to be explained is, why are these groups doing better than the national average? Why are they doing better than better educated, more privileged white students? Because if we could understand how that's happening, if we weren't afraid to talk about that and have a conversation about it, if we could pull back the curtain and try to understand what's going on in those cultures, in those families, maybe that's something we could all learn from. So now to tell you more about what we found that the explanation was, here's Amy.
Well, first of all, thank you all for coming. Some of you may know that I went to El Cerrito High School across the Bay, so it's great to be back home. So to pick up where Jed left off, we looked at the groups that are disproportionately successful today, at least some of these groups. And I want to stress again that these groups change very quickly over time, and they also include people, African-Americans. America's most successful groups include African-Americans and Hispanic-Americans, which actually just debunks racial stereotypes. It shows that it has nothing to do with skin color racial background. And the fact that Jed pointed out that Asian Americans actually become just like the rest of the country after two generations shows that there's nothing innate about it. It's not like intrinsic to a culture. There's something much more wrapped up with the immigrant experience. So we looked at these groups. You know, what do they have in common? What do Nigerian Americans and Mormons and Indian Americans have in common? And what we found is that for all their enormous diversity, they shared three qualities or cultural commonalities. And we call these the triple package. The first is essentially a sense of exceptionality, of being special in some way. The second is almost the opposite of that, just a dash of insecurity, a feeling or worry that you haven't done enough yet, that you're not good enough yet. And the third is impulse control, essentially self-discipline, the ability to resist temptation and to persevere. And it's really the combination of those first two qualities that are almost contradictory that is what fascinates us, and that's what is at the heart of this book. How does somebody simultaneously feel insecure and superior? And we say that it's precisely that combination that kind of generates this almost like a goading drive, a chip on the shoulder, the feeling that, why are you looking down on me? I need to prove myself. I need to gain your respect. I need to show the world. And that anyone of any background from anywhere can have these three qualities. I think President Obama has them. Steve Jobs is the classic. He's always described as having a narcissistic personality. He thought he could transform the world. But by all accounts, in the world, in the words of his a close friend, he also always had a chip on the shoulder, possibly from being an orphan, but that drove him and made him extremely competitive. And of course, he's famous for being extremely disciplined. So anyone can have these qualities, but our research showed, or at least we're arguing, that at this moment, and this is just a snapshot, 2013, at this moment, some groups in America are instilling these qualities in their members, in their kids, in their families, more than others. And these groups are disproportionately succeeding. And in the book, we explore the fascinating, totally different ways that these qualities manifest themselves. So, for example, I was talking about a superiority complex. This sense of exceptionality in a group can be rooted in religion, as in the case of the Mormons, who have a very strong chosen people narrative, very much borrowed from the Jews. Mormons also have a sense of enormous pride in their strong families and clean-cut values. They see themselves, in one historian's words, as an island of morality in a sea of decay, in a sea of moral decay. Iranian Americans have a very strong sense of ethnic exceptionality, too. They're very proud of their ancient civilization. They identify as Persians, as distinct from Arabs. They speak Farsi. Similarly, Cuban Americans see themselves as distinct from other Hispanic Americans. And I mention those two because this highlights one of the great dangers of the superiority complex. This sense of ethnic pride can easily shade into intolerance. We're not like those other groups. And that's why we chose this term, superiority complex, to highlight the dangers of it. And this is also part of the generational arc. The first generation, the immigrants, come over with a sense of, I mean, they're outsiders. We feel this strong identity. Their children, the immigrants' children, they are imbued with America's greatest value, the norm of equality. And they don't quite like or quite get their parents' sense of exceptionality. They feel like, wait, I want to intermarry, maybe. I don't get what you're saying about exceptionality. And they challenge their parents' sense, and that's part of this dynamic that is part of the greatness of America. There's another form of exceptionality. In the case of Asian Americans, you know, we write about there are many different Asian Americans in this country, so different. We focus on Chinese Americans and Indian Americans. But in a sense, part of the exceptionality of Asian Americans, or Chinese Americans, I'm sorry, and Indian Americans is rooted not so much in the Middle Kingdom or Confucianism, anything like that, but in the sense that we are better at working hard. We are better at excelling academically. Now, by itself, a superiority complex doesn't generate drive or success, just the opposite. If you feel superior, you're more likely to be complacent and sit on your laurels. It's only when that sense of superiority is combined with a little insecurity that you get this goading drive that I refer to, this kind of, again, this need to prove yourself. And it's very interesting to note that almost all of America's disproportionately successful groups today are outsiders in one sense or another. Mormons often feel that they're not quite accepted by mainstream America. And viewed with their sense of exceptionality, that's you know, they felt looked down upon. And that's part of what gives them the charge. Iranian Americans, so proud of their heritage, come to this country, find themselves often pegged as terrorists. Again, that combination can create this sense we need to gain the respect and more. Just to be an immigrant in general, is to be insecure. You know, you're the ones with the funny accents. People look at you funny. You're, you know, the ultimate outsiders. And just to add a personal note here, because this book has been so mischaracterized, not for Jed, but for me, at a personal level, in some ways, this book is about how to turn being an outsider into a source of strength. When I was little, I went to Del Mar across the bay. I remember there was a kid in fourth grade who just kept making fun of me. He made slanty-eyed gestures all the time and made fun. At that time, I had a Chinese accent. And I remember I was upset about it, and I came home and told my mom that this guy was making these slanty-eyed gestures at me. And my mom said, she was annoyed with it. She was like, why do you care? If that boy is so stupid, you know, we come from the most ancient, the greatest civilization, we're from a people of scholars, like, why would you even think about that? And I know there, of course, that can dangers of ethnocentrism, but for a kid in fourth grade, that sense of ethnic pride gave me a kind of armor, a kind of shield against majority prejudice. And this phenomenon is very common, this kind of ability for a minority or an immigrant, it's not easy to turn that ethnic heritage, again, into a kind of armor. And we knew the book would be thought-provoking, but we really intended it to be so much more broadly applicable. And I'm just starting to get emails now because, you know, so many people feel like they're outsiders. We received an email from somebody who is disabled. He's an amputee. And he wrote me, I understand these three elements perfectly. They resonate with me and so many other disabled people. For me, it's being disabled and not wanting to be pitied that generates the drive in me and this feeling that I need to work 20 times harder than anyone else. And when I, an amputee, skied past, he was a ski champion, skied past the two-legged skiers, I did feel superior because I had earned it, you know. And so there, you know, when students have said to me, how about gays? Somebody on Morning Joe, Mika Brzezinski, asked me, how does this apply to women? So that was kind of the conversation we were hoping we might have. So anyway, so far I've been talking about insecurity of the sort, insecurity vis-a-vis one's place in society. That's, you know, being an immigrant or looked down on. But equally important, and maybe more startling, and I think this part is controversial, there's a different kind of insecurity that we write about. And this is an insecurity created inside the family. Basically, parents making their children feel that they are not good enough yet. And this idea of deliberately making a child feel this way is practically anathema to mainstream thinking. And yet, the groups that we look at that are so disproportionately successful do it in very, very different ways. So in Asian American immigrant families, again, I'm talking mostly about Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese, Japanese, South Asian, these parents famously impose exorbitantly high expectations on their children. And this is not a stereotype. Hundreds of studies bear this out. So the proverbial, why just a 99, not 100? Right, that's not good enough. Studies also show that especially East Asian parents are much more likely than other parents to make comparisons with other successful kids. So I heard that so-and-so's kid just got into Harvard. Or, you know, your cousin just got valedictorian. Again, instilling that feeling that other people, everyone else is doing better. And to pile on, in these families, academic success is often tied to family honor. If you don't do well, you're going to disgrace the whole family. I mean, talk about pressure. And this is not just Asian Americans. In a study of over 5,000 immigrant children, this is from all backgrounds, the children studied repeatedly said that they felt an acute anxiety, that if they didn't succeed academically, they would be failing their parents and wasting all the sacrifices their parents had made. And this mentality is the exact opposite of what parents focused on self-esteem are trying to generate. It's the exact opposite. And as we wrote in our New York Times op-ed, there is an ocean of difference between a parental message that is, you're amazing, mommy and daddy never want you to worry about a thing, and this parental message, if you don't do well at school, you'll let down the whole family and end up a bum on the streets. It's pretty harsh, but it lights a fire. And finally, the third element is impulse control. And we show that all of America's disproportionately successful groups impose much more discipline and sort of focused activities on their children at a very young age. So these are the three elements of the triple package that we say, in combination, produce both a kind of a hunger, a longing to rise, in Tocqueville's words, and the ability to rise. Now, before I turn this over back to Jed, who will conclude, I want to say that we chose these three terms very deliberately. We could have written a book about success that was really sugarcoating. You know, you just need some confidence and some grit and believe in yourself, and you can be successful. We deliberately chose terms that are quite ambivalent. A superiority complex, insecurity. They are very negative, actually. And that's because we did not intend this for this book to be a celebration of the triple package or of success. We wanted this to be an honest exploration, in a way, of what it takes to generate drive. How do you motivate people? Well, you know, and if you think about all the driven people you know, or just think about it, to be driven, something has to be missing. Something has to be pushing you. If you feel totally great, you probably aren't going to be so driven. And we spend more than half the book exploring the underside of the triple package. That feeling that you need to prove yourself, whether to society, that you haven't pleased your parents enough, that you're not good enough, can be extremely unpleasant. And at its extreme, it can be quite devastating. We quote Amy Tan, who said, I grew up thinking I would never, ever please my parents. And she said, it's a horrible feeling. There were times that I just wanted to die. So the last thing I'll say is, because we've had this criticism, that one thing that we take actually as a critique of the triple package is that this form of insecurity combined with exceptionality that generates a need to prove yourself, to show everybody, tends to channel children into kind of conventional materialistic careers. Just think about it, because the kind of insecurity, we need to show everybody, we need to show our friends, we need to gain respect from society. You're going to want to push your kids, be a doctor, you know, be a surgeon, be something that people can recognize. And sometimes the children in these cultures don't want to be those things. They want something else, and that we consider as a negative. So then,
you might wonder why I stand up. I think it's because I always wanted to give a TED Talk, and nobody's asked me yet, so I don't know. But we've been talking a lot about groups so far. I just wanted to stress a word about individuals. At the end of the day, this book is about individuals. Any individual from any background can have these three qualities. Plenty of people, not from these groups that we focused on, have these qualities. In any given family, a strong parent, a strong grandparent, teachers can instill these qualities. We talk in our book about the case of Sonia Sotomayor, a justice of the United States Supreme Court, raised in a Puerto Rican family. Her father's alcoholic. Her mom wasn't around the house as much as she might have been. Justice Sotomayor was giving herself insulin shots for her diabetes at the age of 8. That's the kind of, you know, grit she had. But the most amazing thing is she says that when she was in fifth grade, she wasn't a great student at that time. She went up to the best student in the class. She says, I did something very unusual for a fifth grader. And I asked, I don't understand. How do you study? How do you do it? And she had a talk with this student. And she copied that student, and within a couple of years, she was one of the best students in the class, and the rest is history. So, and the point of that story is, oh, see how easy it is? Sonia Sotomayor did it. No, that's how hard it is to do that. I mean, what are we saying about groups that are poor and disadvantaged in America? What are we saying about them? What are the causes of poverty there? Everybody knows the causes of poverty for those groups. It's a history of discrimination, slavery, exclusion, denials of opportunity, structural problems, a changing economic base that has nothing to do with culture. Everybody knows that. We know America needs to change. We have to level the playing field. We have to have jobs. We have to try to end discrimination. That's how you're going to best end poverty in groups with entrenched poverty. But knowing all that, if we also know that in some of America's disproportionately successful groups, certain behaviors are helping them succeed, don't we also want to understand that and communicate that? I mean, can't we say that Asian American kids' study habits have something to do with the fact of their educational achievement? I mean, apparently you're not allowed to say that because that would be cultural racism. But, I mean, it's just common sense. And if you know that, don't you want that information to be available? I mean, if you don't, if what you say is, no, there's nothing the poor in America can do. They have to wait for economic change. They have to wait for political intervention. They have to wait for social activism. They have to wait for the end of discrimination. Good luck. You'll be waiting 100 years. Isn't it more respectful? Isn't it more hopeful to say, no, you have some agency too. There is something you also can do in your lives to help you and your kids do better? You know, I'm going to say one more thing, then I'm going to stop because we'd really love to hear your questions because I know there's a question that you want to ask, so I'm going to ask it for you. How come you define success in terms of material wealth? I know you want to ask us that. And the answer is we don't. You know, here's my definition of success. It's achieving your goals, whatever they are. Now, yes, we focus on material wealth and educational achievement in our book for the most part, for about two-thirds of it, not all the way through. And we do that because it's something you can measure, but it's also something that, for a lot of people, is an important goal. And it is important, especially for the underprivileged, for the disadvantaged, to know what are the behaviors that are helping people achieve that goal. But, ultimately, we think the triple package is not about educational achievement or occupational or making success or making money. We think that these qualities empower people to succeed in all kinds of ways. There's many different kinds of success. You cannot equate income with a successful life, a well-lived life, a moral life. But we think these qualities can empower people to achieve success of any kind. One of the things that we observe in our book is, you know, there's a number of things that can happen to these groups that are succeeding. Their success tends to dissipate by the second generation. Well, the ethnic group, there's three possibilities. The ethnic group could just disappear through outmarriage. Or there could be a generational decline. But a more intriguing possibility is that the next generation of kids who are raised with some of these strengths and abilities, they turn around, they look at their parents and say, we don't want to succeed the way you wanted us to. We don't want to be the doctors or engineers or whatever you thought. We don't want to necessarily do what society is telling us to do. This is one of the greatnesses of America, that these qualities collide with American individualism and rebelliousness. This is the process of creative destruction I referred to at the beginning, and empower people to decide for themselves what they want their lives to be. And we think that the real promise of a triple package America would be a day when there were no more successful groups in which individuals were better able to write the scripts of their own lives and pursue success as they define it. And we'd love to take your questions.
Great. Thank you very much for those very elucidating opening comments. I have questions, and the questions here actually is typical at the Commonwealth Club. The audience questions are wonderful and really, I think, frame things. I'm just curious about one thing before we get into the details of the theses. How do you both go from writing about global economics, about serious constitutional law issues? I've used your horn book, actually, Jed. How do you go from that to where you are now, something that's so personal in many ways, like you did with Battle Hymn and in this book? What's that about, that progression?
Well, I don't know. I mean, in a funny way, you know, it was just, you know, just being teachers at the law school, I mean, we began to notice strange facts about our students. Like, are there three Mormons in this little class? I mean, are there more, Cuban Americans than you might expect? And at first we thought, too small sample size, just Yale, it's not representative. And then we thought, well, wait, maybe somebody should go and look at this data all around the country and see if this is a national phenomenon. And it was. And we were genuinely curious about that. And I think that's why we wrote the book, because of that.
Well, there's actually, we didn't get to the last chapter. There are constitutional law angles. I mean, we've been embroiled in this controversy. And I've actually written about successful minorities globally and the conflict with democratization also.
Okay. The first question actually that came up from the audience is one that I think is fair to say. And that deals with methodology. I mean, I will try and mirror some of the critical comments that have been made to help move the discussion along, and one of them is that this is really anecdotal, that there's all kinds of generalizations, and you counter that in the book by saying every one of the premises underlying the theory of the triple package is supported by well-substantiated and relatively uncontroversial body of empirical evidence. Given the controversial nature of your claims, how can you make that statement?
Well, it's a very data-driven book. I mean, we have 100 pages of endnotes, which is, unusual for a book that's aimed at a wide audience. People can read the endnotes if they want. They can go and check every single fact that we assert, and we never assert any facts about a group, its performance, its outlook, its attitudes, unless those facts are backed up by hard empirical data, survey data, sociological experiments. So there's that. And then there's the question of how do you know, how do you test that these qualities are the things that are driving success? Well, in a way, part of that's just common sense. I mean, come on. How is it that Asian American kids are doing so well academically? It's got to have something to do with their work habits once you eliminate any hypothesis about innate ability, which we do. But, it's also true that there's all this experimental data out there that support the particular qualities of the triple package that we identify and show their association with success. So the stereotype boost literature shows that if you believe that you're a member of a group that does well at something, that increases your performance when you get tested on that skill. This has been shown time and time again. And it's a remarkable finding, and that supports what we say about how a superiority complex can help people succeed. Or I'll just give you one more example. Okay, how many people, you're going to know about this, but how many people here in this room know about the marshmallow test? Okay, most of you know. This is the most famous social psychology test ever performed. About 30 years ago, they put kids, 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old kids, at a table, and they put a marshmallow in front of them. And they said, you can eat the marshmallow right now, but if you wait 15 minutes, you'll get a second marshmallow. Well, most of the kids, they ate the first marshmallow. They just ate it right up. But about a third of them waited the full 15 minutes and got the second marshmallow. The amazing thing was that almost by accident, the researchers at Stanford who conducted that experiment tracked the kids 20 years later. They weren't intending to, but they did. And to everyone's surprise, it turned out that the kids who had waited were wildly more successful on all the conventional metrics. They were educationally outperforming the others. They were occupationally outperforming the others. They were earning more money. The families were stronger, less jail time, less substance abuse. And this finding has now been replicated over and over all over the world. That ability, that's impulse control, that ability is a more stronger predictor of success than IQ. Now, in some cultures, in some groups, something going on in the family is strengthening that ability. And studies also show that this is an ability you can strengthen. It's not innate. You can strengthen this ability in kids. And what we wrote the book about was, well, if that's true, if we're beginning to understand this information, immigrants' kids have been doing great in America for wave after wave of immigrants. The Italian Americans, the Irish Americans, you see the same story. Kids of immigrants have this charge packed into them, this special charge. They do better. Why? It's not magic. Something's going on in those families. If we could understand that formula, isn't that something maybe we could all benefit from? Let me ask you this.
Actually, somebody raised the marshmallow experiment in the question, and it's true that the book has 40, 50 pages of well-documented endnotes that I think the reader appreciates. But if it is so data-driven and so based on scientific findings, How do you account for the reaction that you've gotten? And actually, somebody asked a question. Well, that question was asked, but also people were wondering about the connection to being law professors. And somebody writes, does it seem people react so strongly to your writing because they see it as so declarative, letter of the law thesis, rather than as a personal exploration? So I'm just wondering, how do you reconcile all the data with, you know, very smart people and very respected publications, by and large, with the strong reaction that you've gotten?
Well, Amy's pointing to me, so I'll take one last stab at this, and I'm not going to answer any more questions because I'm talking too much. But
oh, yes, you are.
Look, so sociology is not a science. At its best, it's a data-driven interpretive discipline. Our book is data-driven, and then we interpret the data. Everybody's free to interpret data and facts. We offer an interpretation. As lawyers, we are trained to look at complex fact patterns and statistics and try to understand the causes and then try to prescribe policy. That's what lawyers do in the United States today. That's what we try to teach our students to do at Yale Law School. I'm looking at a couple of my students right now. And if they want to check, I'll tell you, did we conduct the 50,000 subject study with controlled sample groups and code for the qualities that we find and see whether in this randomized test you could predict success based on our qualities? No. Okay, of course we haven't conducted such an experiment. Could sociologists go and conduct such experiments now on the basis of our hypothesis and try to prove or disprove it? Yes. That's the point of offering a hypothesis like that. And we would welcome such attempts to prove.
Just quickly, I think part of it is also, it's a strange genre. I think some of the criticisms or the observations are correct. It's not an academic article. It's just clearly not. And I think a lot of people want to take it as a how-to guide. If you read the first page, what I think it is I think I'd like the Financial Times review. It's a meditation on success, right? And including its dark side, its costs. It's like an honest view of what generates drive in some groups, and then let's debate it, you know? And I think people, I don't know, I think it's a funny genre, yeah. Kind of.
Well, let's drill a little further down into the thesis and the three factors, because somebody asked a question here that I think is kind of the flip side of it and actually an interesting lens to look at it through. The question is, are there common traits that describe why some groups decline and stagnate, performing much worse than the American average? In other words, looking at it from the flip side, if you will.
Yeah, well, actually, I'll just echo what Jed said. I mean, if you ask us, this is just our personal view, it's not really what the book is about America's most disadvantaged, poorest groups. I think we think that the causes of that are history. I mean, I think that there's just no way around it. It is a history of slavery, of denial of opportunity. So it has nothing to do with lack of a triple package or culture, right? These are historical causes. And that's right in our book. Now, what we do say is that it's weird, this explosive reaction against our book. In a way, it's almost like people want to say, if you flip it, I think it's actually more reactionary to say that therefore there is nothing that can be done. The reason we have poverty and inequality is all this other stuff. People who are successful came over with more education, or they're more successful. It's all discrimination. We need to do it at a systemic level. To me, that's very, it's actually very depressing that, because we've had emails. Let me just tell you about one person. One very nice population of people who have been sending us positive emails are teachers, educators. And I got this email from one guy who said, I'm Latino, I teach in Southern California, I teach public high school, and I'm also a father. And I don't get this controversy. I think about culture and success all the time. I look around and I see that my Chinese American kids have different study habits that are leading to this kind of, more academic success. And he said, so I told my own son, do what they're doing. We're going to do what they're doing. And now he's a straight-A student. And I think the inability to say that, no, you can't say that Chinese Americans have, at this point, have different study habits, because that would be creating a model minority stereotype, and that would be, cultural racism. I think that is actually, it may be, people have been commenting, we've poured so much money, and yet we've made so little progress in education, fighting inequality, anti-poverty policies. Well, maybe part of it is because we are not allowed to talk about culture at all. It is taboo, so we tie one hand behind our back. We can only operate with these other things, but we can't look at this. And I think if we could infuse some of this into our policies, we would make better progress.
I do at this point want to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Jeffrey Brand, professor and chairman of the Center for Law and Global Justice at the University of San Francisco School of Law, and your moderator for today's program. Our guests today and are Professor Amy Chua and Professor Jed Rubenfeld, and we're discussing their latest book, The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. You go to great lengths in the book, and people in the audience are interested in this, to distinguish between culture and race and ethnicity, as I read it. But the truth is that the reviews that have read it, and I think it would that I owe it to just give you a sense, not give you, but give the audience a sense of some of the language, of reviewers who complain that this really, despite the protestations to the contrary, this really is about race. So one writes that the book is a series of shock arguments wrapped in self-help tropes meant to do what racist arguments do, scare people. Another critique says that the book buys into exceptionalist arguments to explain disparities and means endorsing a dehumanizing system of racialized norms. Now, that kind of inflammatory language, how do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I'll just be honest. That's just outrageous language. You know who's trying to scare people there? The author of that language is trying to scare people into not looking at culture, not looking at these facts. We're supposed to bury our heads, not learn from it. You know how the only way to change facts is to look at them in the face. Calling facts racist is not going to change them. That kind of review says, if you dare to talk about culture, if you dare to say that behaviors are helping some people succeed, and by the way, if it's not behaviors, you know, what is it? If you dare to say that, that's racist. That's the scare tactic. That's like, oh, so you just shut that conversation down and never have it.
I'll just quickly respond directly, though. I feel bad that we even have to do this, but the whole point of our book, it's on the first page, is we show that some of America's most successful groups today are African American and Hispanic American. Therefore, success has nothing to do with race and skin color. And a lot of my students are saying, wow, do they know what real racist arguments are like? You know, I mean, it's unbelievable. The whole point of our book is that what propels people and groups to success are qualities and behaviors that anyone can have. And secondly, on the cultural racism point, again, it's actually in the title of our book. You know, I'm not sure they read the book. That might be the case if you're thinking about culturists. Oh, it has something to do with this 5,000-year Confucianism that only people like that can have. But in fact, our book defines culture in a very dynamic way, which is we point out that after two generations, Asian Americans are no longer more successful. So that shows that it's actually very fluid. You know, it's something in that immigrant experience that once you come here and you get more successful, you lose that insecurity, that kind of goes away. So I think there's nothing that could possibly be construed as some cultures being innately superior to others.
Yeah. You know, hearing the passion in your voice in response to this, and I appreciate your responding so forthrightly to hard questions to ask, is there a part of you, given the reaction, that wishes you hadn't written the book?
Yeah.
Straight question.
I have been very upset. You know, when Amy's been getting the hate mail. Okay, Amy's been getting the hate mail, and it's very upsetting to me, and it's upsetting because I'm saying to myself, how come they're not sending me more hate mail? I mean, what do I have to do? So, yeah, it's very upsetting. No, I mean, the honest answer for me, and I'll let Amy speak for herself, is we're professors. We have tenure. You know what's part of our job is that we're supposed to be able to say controversial things. If we believe it, we say it, damn the consequences. If I get to the point where I'm not going to write about something that I believe because I know some people will find it controversial, you know, I don't deserve to have tenure and I should resign my position, which I'm not doing.
I was going to say I was going to lighten things up with the next question, but you managed to do that some. But I think beneath what has some humor in this question, I think is a question as to the utility and viability or of the theory itself. And let me just read the question. It sounds like Jed had very permissive parents while Amy had very strict ones. Yet both of you have become Yale law professors. If the triple package values are so important, how did Jed do it? And Amy, you can answer.
Yeah. Well, that's part of what got us interested in this, you know, and Jed will say this more forcefully than me. This is not a parenting book. I think that's another reason for, I think this book is sort of reviewed and discussed in light of the memoir, Tiger Mother. But in a way, what we were trying to show is that, you know, you could have these three elements that we're talking about can be instilled in families and people in such different ways. I was just trying to explain to you all the different ways that you can instill this dash of insecurity I was talking about. And, you know, the Mormon case is very interesting. We used to joke around in our house. I would say that, you know, the Chinese are just three generations behind the Jews. And we talk about this in our book because if you look at Jews around the turn of the 20th century, that is on the Lower East Side, they are the all these studies and testimonials, they sound so much like Chinese immigrants today. But you have to play the piano or the violin. You have to be a doctor. You have to get straight A's. They are several generations ahead and don't remember that anymore in some ways.
But there are many ways to instill insecurity. There's a famous old Jewish joke. So the Jewish daughter is elected president of the United States. And she says to her mom, "Mom, you're going to come to the inauguration, right?" And the mom says, "Oh, do I have to? It's so much trouble." And the daughter says, "Come on, Mom, you got to come." And the mom says, okay, I'll come." So the mom goes to the inauguration, her daughter's being inaugurated president of the United States, and the mom pulls the sleeve of the person sitting next to her, and she says, "You see that woman being inaugurated president?" And the guy says, "Yeah, I see her." He says, "Her brother is a doctor." So it's like, you get to be elected president, and you could have been a doctor. So, you know, there are many ways to it. Now, I would, of myself, I'm not sure that I am a triple package person. I mean, compared to my wife, I'm a slacker. Forget the discipline. I mean, so, you know, but my point is, there's not one method of parenting that goes along with instilling these values. It can happen in many different ways.
Yeah, I want to turn to the issue of success. In your statement here, Jed, you talked about any kind of success being important, or not only material success being important. One person in the audience asked, "What's happiness got to do with it?" To paraphrase Tina Turner. But I want to read a quote from your book that struck me. It says, "Everyone should have two educations." I hope I have this right. "One about how to make a living and the other about how to live. Triple package success, with its emphasis on external measures of achievement, does not provide the latter education, i.e., how to live." And if that's the case, what does happiness have to do with it? And why is this a good thing?
I'm so glad you read that, you know, because that's so early on in our book, you know, and there are all these criticisms by people who I guess haven't seen it. I mean, this is the opening of our book. And as I said, that I think that explains what our book is about. It's sort of a view and trying to think through these issues. Now, I think that you can also romanticize not being successful. You know, I mean, it would be very easy if it were that you just do whatever you want. It is not that happiness producing to not be able to get the job you want. It is not that happiness producing to, as Jed says, have a goal and find that no one wants to hire you for that goal. So we treat this, I think, fairly complexly. I will tell you, personally, I think my mom is in the audience, I you know, I saw some of the narrowness of this, and we explored this. You know, when I was little, that first generation that comes over, they're afraid for their survival, right? They don't know if they can make it. That's why they want their children to do these respectable careers. You know, be a doctor. Be something that we know you can survive. We're scared if you want to just be a poet or a jazz musician. And my parents definitely wanted me to go to medical school and to be a scientist, and I was just not good at it. And I tried to be pre-med, and it took me, in a way, 20 years to, you know, I majored in economics because I tried to persuade them that was sort of like a science. And I wasn't. I'm a lot older now. It's different. Believe it or not, when I went to law school, my parents were incredibly upset. There were very few Asian law students. There was a rebellious thing on my part. So I know personally what it's like to be in that kind of, there's like a narrow focus. And so when you ask about happiness, I mean, I think we treat this quite well. You know, we talk about Ong Lee, Jed's joke. You know, Ong Lee describes himself as a triple package person. His very much never being good enough for his father, this constant feeling. And the only kind of bittersweet joke there, he says that after he won the Academy Award, best director, first Chinese American, you know, his father said, well, you know, you're still young. Now maybe you can go be an academic. Yeah. And, you know, so, and I think we're quite honest about that. And I, is that something? And that's, we're laying it out for people. You know, do you think, let me just give one final example when you ask me about happiness. Vera Wang, one of my idols, celebrity fashion designer. She does wedding dresses for Kim Kardashian, Chelsea Clinton. Her testimonials are so moving. Same thing. She said, you know, I never pleased my father. He didn't want me to do this. And she says, even to this day, I can only think about what I am doing wrong. Never, you know. So if you ask yourself as a parent, do you want your child to feel that way? I think our first instinct, certainly mine, is like, no, that would be terrible to raise a child that feels that they're never good enough. But then you think about, wait, but she's Vera Wang. And a lot of people want to be Vera Wang, and probably a lot of people are less happy than Vera Wang. So, I mean, we lay it out there. You know, I think it's interesting to think about.
Let me take it back to the academic setting and an example that Jed raised. Thank you for that answer, by the way. About the number of Nigerians, I think, was the example you used in business schools. I think in the book you also talk about that in admissions at Harvard Law School, the number of immigrant blacks, if I'm using the phrases that you used, far exceeds the number of African Americans in the class. And I guess that the question that I have, and it's a question that somebody else raised here in terms of money and privilege, doesn't that assume a level playing field? And doesn't the statistic of more Nigerians or more immigrant blacks say more about Harvard and discrimination in America than it does about having the triple package?
It might. I mean, you have to be willing to look at the facts in the face. If you think so, dig down the data and explain how that's working. I'll listen to the explanation, but look, we're not the first ones to be pointing this out. So starting about 10 years ago, people started to notice this strange phenomenon at America's selective schools. At Yale, of the 18 members of the Yale Law School, of the 18 members of the Black Law Students Association last year, only two were not immigrants themselves or the children of immigrants. So this is an astonishing phenomenon. And, you know, we think it's worth looking at.
But I think we agree with that.
The essential explanation of it is, of course, a history of discrimination and patterns of segregation in our society and denials of opportunities, schools that won't teach. Our point is simply, let's look at all the facts in the face. Let's be willing to recognize that, let's give these Nigerian American second generation kids and Korean American, Vietnamese American, Chinese American kids their due. That is, they are outperforming white, more educated, more privileged kids. How is that happening? Is it magic? No, it's not magic. How is it being done? Let's look at how it's being done. And you see some of this in West Indian families, African immigrant families, Nigerians and others, and in Asian Americans.
It's not an isolated phenomenon.
I want to say something about the, we have, I think, a very subtle chapter talking about African Americans, and none of it has come out. We don't have all the answers, but what we do talk about, for example, it's so interesting, the black power movements of the 60s precisely wanted to try to create a superiority complex. So this is out there, you know. We talk about historically black colleges and universities, not saying it's good or bad, but it is astonishing how many African American leaders in this country, non-immigrants, attended those colleges. Again, a lot of those colleges, I mean, one of their goals is to instill, to counter this majority narrative of inferiority, and to say, let's, you know, it makes a difference. Let's instill, try to instill pride. And also, you know, it maybe makes a difference when your valedictorian is African American, when your math star is African American, when your spelling bee champion is African American. So we actually, I think these are the interesting issues that we should be talking about. I mean, I feel like we've been kind of blocked from getting to these interesting debates because it's, you know, it's racist even to raise it. But I mean, I think this is a place where progress could be made, you know, controversial as it is.
You know, there's so much to talk about here, and there's at least two areas that we haven't gotten to, and I want to at least get to one of them, but I want to say something about one of them, which is the triple package, quote-unquote, and how it relates to America as a country. The chapter on that in the book, which I believe is near the end, is very provocative. You're arguing that America has lost its triple package. And I guess my question about that is, and you say particularly in the second half of the 20th century, but lost what? Lost McCarthy? Lost Jim Crow? And could you just talk to that briefly?
Yes, but I want to go back to the previous question for one second.
Sure, go ahead.
And tell you about another twist on the marshmallow test that we were talking about before. One of the most fascinating things we found, and it's in our book, is something we call the reverse marshmallow test. What they did was they re-ran the marshmallow test, but here's what they did first. With half the kids, they lied to them. So they promised them some art supplies if they would just do something or other, and the kids that did that something or other, but then they didn't deliver the art supplies. Broken promise. Then they ran the marshmallow test. All the kids who were lied to grabbed that marshmallow. Yeah. And now that's just rational. Because if you don't trust the system, if you think the system's a fraud and unfair, if you don't believe people like you can make it, if you don't believe that hard work and working within the system is going to be rewarded, why should you try to do that? Why don't you just grab that marshmallow? And so, ironically, some of these immigrant groups that come into this country, they may believe in American institutions more than we Americans do. Maybe they even have an artificially inflated sense of the fairness and the equity of American institutions. You actually find this in surveys of immigrants all the time. And so that can be part of the explanation, too. Now, to get to the question you asked me, well, we think that the triple package values are traditional American values in a very easily demonstrable way. A sense of exceptionality, you know that American exceptionalism, everybody's documented that. The insecurity, America was born in all of our borders were under threat. And we had a chip on our shoulder vis-a-vis aristocratic Europe. They looked down on us. We're trying to prove that democracy and equality. Of course, we weren't totally democratic and equal at the time, were we? But trying to prove that the new system could be just as good and impulse control. Well, you know who first said no pain, no gain? Actually, in almost those words was Ben Franklin. One of his proverbs is all about, you know, this pure inheritance of self-restraint and discipline was a very important part of American culture. So, triple package, very much built into American history. You can see it in the Constitution, too, but put that aside, something we think has happened in the last 30 or 40 years, which has eroded some of the insecurity and impulse control. You see a lot more emphasis on immediate gratification, on short-term thinking. You see this in corporate leaders who are trying to make those billions really quick, heedless of the consequences of their actions for the rest of the country. That's the opposite of triple package deferred. That's immediate gratification. Who cares what the next generation's going to bear? Who cares what the future will come to. So we see this kind of loss of some of these triple package values, and we do think that it would be that we need as a country to get them back, to get back to where we were.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to ask a question that could deserve an hour answer, but I'm going to ask you to do it in one minute. And it's about the downside of the triple package. And you have a very sobering sentence in your or two in the book. At its worst, the triple package can misshape lives and break psyches. Children made to believe they are failures or worthless if they don't win every prize may realize in their 20s that they've spent their lives striving for things they never even wanted. And if that's true, is this worth it?
Jeffrey, that's at its extreme, and I'm so glad that you're reading that, you know, because it's, again, it's right from our book. We go through the negative side of each of these components. Obviously, a superiority complex is part of what drove Nazi Holocaust and apartheid, you know. And again, we chose these terms for a reason. Too much insecurity. I think that to make this short, you know, things can be titrated, right? It's like we quote Amy, some people who just this too much insecurity can make you feel like I'm just not worth, it's not worth living. I'm just not good enough. But there are ways of doing it, obviously, including in the way my parents did it, that it was very empowering. Because I think embedded in this concept of high expectations is ironically both the superiority and the insecurity. You know, if it's done with love, it's like high expectations means like, I know you have it in you. I know you can be anything you want. But you haven't done it yet. So you have to do it, work a little bit harder. So, and that can be enormously empowering too. So, you know, we were saying, that was a direct quote, at its extreme, at its worst, it can be this. And again, I think we try to be quite nuanced in our discussion.
But let's not forget that the other extreme, no expectations, a childhood of entitlement. Does that make kids happy? I mean, if you, as Amy was saying, if you feel entitled to everything, you don't have to work for anything, you're going to get disappointed later and you may not be raised to be a very good human being. And in fact, studies show that the kids raised on a steady diet of self-esteem and entitlement feeling are not happier and have tons of psychological problems. So at both extremes, it produces unhappiness. And the point of our book is, can't we find some balance between the extremes?
Yeah. Well, we do actually have to stop. The last question that somebody had asked was about Valentine's Day, and I think we'll just have to leave that to a glass of wine with our partners and hopefully the roses and discuss, because the question was, what makes a happy marriage? One thing clearly that helps is a vibrant exchange and people willing to engage in tough issues, and you've done that. And just the final words, there was a great quote from Sid Caesar that I just thought was so perfect for today. Everybody wants to have a goal. I got to get to that goal. I got to get to that goal. I got to get to that goal, he said. Then you get to that goal, and then you got to get to another goal. But in between goals is a thing called life that has to be lived and enjoyed. And if you don't, you're a fool. So we... I want to give our sincere thanks to Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld. It's been wonderful. Authors of The Triple Package. The book is here. The book will be outside. I urge you to get a copy. They'll be here to sign it, as I understand it. How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. And we also thank our audience here and on the radio, on the television, and on the Internet. I'm Jeffrey Brand, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you so much.